Across the street, Klockner listened to the brief chat with Pagnozzi one more time, then called Langley. The final piece of the puzzle had just fallen into place, and Mr. DeVille would want to know it immediately. While dependent on fancy words and smooth talk and compelling photos, the scam was basic in its operation. It preyed on human desire, and it paid off by sheer terror. Its mechanics had been solved by Mr. Garb's file, and by the Brant White reverse scam and by other letters they'd intercepted. Only one question had gone unanswered. When aliases were used to rent post office boxes, how did the brethren find the real names of their victims? The phone calls to Philadelphia had just given them their answer. Trevor simply hired a local private detective, evidently one with less business than Mr. Pagnozzi. It was almost 10 when DeVille was finally cleared to see Teddy. The North Koreans had shot another American soldier in the DMZ, and Teddy had been dealing with the fallout since noon. He was eating cheese and crackers and sipping a Diet Coke when DeVille entered the bunker. After a quick briefing, Teddy said,
"That's what I thought."
His instincts were uncanny, especially with hindsight.
"This means, of course, that the lawyer could hire a local here to somehow uncover the real identity of Al Conyers," DeVille said.
"But how?"
"We can think of several ways. First is surveillance, the same way we caught Lake sneaking to his box. Watch the post office. That's somewhat risky, because there's a good chance you'll get noticed. A second is bribery. $500 cash to a postal clerk will work in a lot of places. Third is computer records. This is not highly classified material. One of our guys just hacked his way into the central post office in Evansville, Indiana, and got the list of all box leases. It was a random test. Took him about an hour. That's high tech. Low tech is simply to break into the post office at night and have a look around."
"How much does he pay for this?"
"Don't know, but we'll find out soon when he hires an investigator."
"He has to be neutralized."
"Eliminated?"
"Not yet. I'd rather buy him first. He's our window. If he's working for us, then we know everything and we keep him away from Conyers. Put together a plan."
"And for his removal?"
"Go ahead and plan it, but we're in no hurry. Not yet, anyway."
Chapter 23. The South did indeed like Aaron Lake, with his love of guns and bombs and tough talk and military readiness. He flooded Florida, Mississippi, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Texas with ads that were even bolder than his first ones. And Teddy's people flooded the same states with more cash than had ever changed hands the night before an election. The result was another rout, with Lake getting 260 of the 312 delegates at stake on Little Super Tuesday. After the votes were counted on March 14th, 1,301 of the 2,066 total delegates had been decided. Lake held a commanding lead over Governor Terry, 801 to 390. The race was over, barring an unforeseen catastrophe. Buster's first job at Trumbull was running a weed eater, for which he earned a starting wage of 20 cents an hour. It was either that or mopping floors in the cafeteria. He chose the weed eating because he liked the sun and vowed that his skin would not turn as pale as some of the bleached out inmates he'd seen. Nor would he get fat like some of them. "This is prison," he kept telling himself. "How can they be so fat?" He worked hard in the bright sun, kept his tan, vowed to keep his flat stomach, and tried gamely to go through the motions. But after 10 days, Buster knew he would not last for 48 years. 48 years. He couldn't begin to comprehend such time. Who could? He'd cried for the first 48 hours.